From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, how a Baltimore school principal is helping her students reckon with the violence that left part of their neighborhood in flames.
But first, remember that record surge in children coming across the U.S. border from Central American countries last summer? According to a new study by the Pew Research Center, there's been a significant drop in the number of unaccompanied children crossing, in large part because Mexico has been deporting record numbers of them before they even get to the U.S. Jens Manuel Krogstad is a writer and editor at Pew. He focuses on Hispanics, immigration, and demographic trends, and he's here with what he's found. Jens, give us a sense of this year compared to last.
Sure. Well, first, like you mentioned, the number of unaccompanied children apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border has dropped pretty dramatically this year over last. So last year, from October to February, about 21,000 children were apprehended. And this year, over that same time period, it was only 12,500. So it's a pretty big drop.
Although when you say only, there are people, I'm sure, saying, well, that's still a lot, 12,000.
Yeah, that's still a lot. But you have to remember that last fiscal year, 65,000 unaccompanied children were apprehended, and that was by far a record number.
Over the year. Well, then tell us about some of the reasons. You say Mexico has deported 56% more children over that same period, that October to February period, than it did the year before.
Yeah, so this year, Mexico has deported about 3,800 unaccompanied minors from Central America. And like you said, that's a 56% increase. And that increase has coincided with a concerted effort by the Mexican government to patrol their southern border. And that new effort was done around the time of this big surge last summer of unaccompanied children crossing into the U.S.
Yeah. Well, and there are people who are concerned about this, by the way. Maureen Meyer is a Mexican immigration expert with the Washington Office on Latin America. She's worried that Mexico's increased deportations and aggressive enforcement that you just described could open up these young migrants to new abuses because they're just being rapidly deported, maybe back to dangerous situations. That's a conversation for another day, but you also found that maybe the situations in at least some countries aren't as dangerous.
Yeah, we found that the situations on the ground in some countries in Central America are changing. For example, in Honduras, drug-related violence has been a problem for a long time. And in 2012, it had the highest homicide rate of any country in the world. It was 86 homicides per 100,000 people. And 2 years later, in 2014, that number had dropped to 68 homicides per 100,000 people.
Still a lot.
still a lot, and that's still one of the highest homicide rates in the world, but it has dropped.
Yeah. Well, but not all the unaccompanied minors were coming to the U.S. from Central American states fleeing violence. You break that down as well. Some were fleeing violence in some countries, but others were coming for economic reasons.
Yeah, that was particularly true among Guatemalan children. They didn't have the extreme violence issues in their home countries that Honduras and El Salvador had. So it's interesting to note that this past year, these first 5 months from October to February, there's been an increase in the share of Guatemalan children, whereas last year, over that same time period, the increases were among Guatemalan, Honduran, and Salvadoran children.
Yeah. You talk about Mexican policy being part of this drop. What about U.S. policy? What impact has that had?
Well, the U.S. has been doing a lot since last summer's record surge. They started a public information campaign in Central America to discourage children from trying to cross into the U.S. because there had been rumors that if they made it to the U.S., they could get some sort of permanent residence or temporary status. There's also a new program to allow some immigrants who are already here illegally to get relief from deportation for their children.
Mm-hmm. And so that also has had an impact on the flow.
Yeah, at least according to U.S. officials, they've been crediting in particular the public information campaign in Central America for helping reduce the flow of unaccompanied minors to the U.S.
Mm. Were you surprised by what you saw, or did this fit what you might expect?
We weren't really surprised. It was interesting to see the number of deportations by the Mexican government. Just to put a number on that, we hadn't looked at the numbers in particular to see that 56% increase, which is pretty significant.
Yeah. Jens Manuel Krogstad, writer and editor at Pew Research Center, with the news that the number of unaccompanied minors crossing from Central American countries into the U.S. has dropped, in part because Mexico has stepped up its deportation of these young people before they get to the border. Jens, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this update now from across the Atlantic, as European and African countries struggle with their own migrant crisis. A record 280,000 people crossed into Europe illegally last year, more than half of them by sea, despite the dangers we've recently seen. Nearly 1,800 people have died trying to cross the Mediterranean so far this year. And yesterday, the EU Commission president said that the EU's response to the crisis has been too little, too late. And with the support of the European Parliament, he called for a mandatory quota system. It would require all 28 EU nations to take care of the refugees, not just leave it to Italy, Malta, Germany. We need to share solidarity, he said. We have to open the doors to make sure they don't come in through the windows.
The National Guard, driving Hummers and wearing fatigues, burned out buildings and boarded up storefronts, helicopters hovering day and night. We've been watching the events unfold in Baltimore with fear and concern, and now we're going to hear from people who are living it, children. Schools were closed Tuesday and Monday after Monday night's violence, but thousands went back to school across the city on Wednesday. NPR's Shireen Marisol Meraji spent the day with a West Baltimore principal, helping her students make sense of it all.
Good morning. How y'all doing? Y'all all right?
Yes.
Just before 8 a.m., Crystal Harden Lindsay meets her kids out front for hugs and hellos before they walk in the door. She's been a principal for 3 years at the Green Street Academy. It's a charter school that goes from middle to high school.
It's going to be a good day today. No worries, right?
Okay. Worries.
No worries.
These kids have a lot to worry about. Most of them live near where the unrest and looting took place. They're nearly all African American and poor. But Miss Lindsay, as the kids call her, is no stranger to their day-to-day. She grew up in East Baltimore, saw her first dead body laying in the street when she was very young. So she knew some of what they needed.
So who can tell me what hope is? Just give me a definition of hope. Somebody. Come on. My man. Hope is faith. All right. Somebody else.
Harden Lindsay called in local pastor Michael Phillips and other black male mentors from around Baltimore to talk with the kids first thing. Give them some hope. The mentors told them the problems in their neighborhood are not about race, but about class. Education is the way out. They said it was okay to be angry, but channel it in positive ways. Some of the kids were skeptical.
Each and every day, we don't have a choice whether to live or to die.
14-year-old Montrell Garrison was a vocal participant in the morning talks.
We just go outside thinking we're going to have some fun, go mess with our friends and all this other stuff. But then again, police officers are training each and every day to kill us.
Right or wrong, other students felt the same way and expressed it in the hallways and the classrooms. Kids asked why cops always stop them for no reason, why they have to be respectful when they do. Miss Lindsay listened, but push back.
A lot of what you say, I can definitely understand in terms of being hopeless, in terms of being angry. But something that the media is not going to tell you that you may not hear every day is that, yes, we have a lot of things that go against us, but we're also very resilient.
And to prove it, she introduced me to two members of the school's garden club.
So this is Khalil and this is Robert.
Hello, I'm Shireen.
Eighth graders Khalil Ben and Robert Carter didn't want to talk about Freddie Gray's death or the police. They just wanted to show off their gardening skills.
We plant our own stuff.
Watermelons, tomatoes. I ate a beet from right out the ground before.
We plant cosmic purple carrots. The carrots and the purple.
Part of Green Street's curriculum is teaching kids sustainability and getting them ready for a green economy. Khalil and Robert also take care of 6 chickens and feed the tilapia in the school's basement. It's helping them learn, but on this day, it's also helping them take their minds off the stress and fear from the world outside of school.
Pardon the interruption. Teachers and scholars, if I could have your attention.
It's getting late in the afternoon now, and Harden Lindsay gets on the loudspeaker to make her final announcements.
Please know that you are in our thoughts, and we're going to be outside waiting to help you to get home. Please have a great afternoon. So I'm going to go and put my little sweat on. I'm going to go outside. because cops are getting out.
She heads out front a few minutes before her kids are dismissed to make sure students from the other two schools that share the campus get on the buses first and with no drama. But it's chaotic. She has to break up a fight between two girls from another school. There are rumors the kids are planning to loot later in the day. And on top of all that, the public buses that take the kids home are running late.
Come on, let's go. Come on, I need y'all to clear the campus. Time to go home. Come on, y'all, time to go home.
When the buses finally arrive, things start to settle down on campus. But Principal Hardin Lindsay says, even on a normal day, saying goodbye is always the hardest part.
Because they're no longer in your control. So when they leave you, you just have to pray that they come back to you the next day.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
The latest from Baltimore now. Police officials say that they have finished their investigation into the controversial death of Freddie Gray. Deputy Commissioner Kevin Davis did not announce the results of the inquiry. He did, though, reveal one new piece of information. He said that the police van made an extra stop as it was transporting Gray.
The second stop has been revealed to us during the course of our investigation and was previously unknown to us. We discovered this new stop based on our thorough and comprehensive and ongoing review of all CCTV cameras and privately owned cameras. And in fact, this new stop was discovered from a privately owned camera.
The state's attorney will now decide how to proceed. Today on the streets of Baltimore, riot police are still on patrol. Even so, after 2 days of calm, many people are now thinking about the next steps. One of those people is economist Anaban Basu. He is CEO of Sage Policy Group. He served on the Baltimore School Board and raised his family in Baltimore. We asked him to describe how Baltimore has been developing economically.
Well, historically, there have been a couple of megatrends, one very negative and one very positive. On the positive side, there's a lot of growth in medical research, cybersecurity, financial services. Baltimore is headquarters to Under Armour, T. Rowe Price, and other rapidly growing companies. Many of the people who work for those companies live in Baltimore suburbs, but many also live in some of the most delightful urban communities on the East Coast. That's the one Baltimore, and it's a vibrant Baltimore. It's a Baltimore people love. There's another Baltimore, a second Baltimore, which is poorer, which is more challenged. There's no question. But you'll notice that in the riots on Monday night, that many of the structures that were burned or looted were new. Mondawmin Mall has been refurbished just in the last few years. That CVS is new. And that senior center was under construction.
So what does this tell you?
That even in the other Baltimore, there's progress. It's a grinding progress. It's a slow level of progress. But there's this notion out there that parts of Baltimore, at least parts of Baltimore, are completely devoid of opportunity. That's just not true. It's absolutely true that the kids who grow up in Baltimore City, for the most part, have less opportunity than in Baltimore's affluent suburbs. That's absolutely true. But this notion that there is no opportunity, that's hyperbole.
And I'm guessing that that opportunity and the growth of those areas did not come easily. I mean, that kind of development happens according to some kind of a larger plan where neighborhoods want it, where the economics are right. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. That these are all the outgrowths of public-private partnerships. It's often nonprofit organizations who are also at the cutting edge of leading these projects forward, of attracting a CVS, of attracting or developing a senior center, of refurbishing Mondawmin Mall. The incomes in these communities that we're talking about are quite low. And so the private sector in and of its own self is not necessarily going to put a lot of investment into these communities. And that's why there is only grinding progress. But it is progress. It is new construction. And that construction is associated with job creation. And there are jobs at that CVS, or were, and at Mondawmin Mall.
And of course, then the painful irony is that there is this looting and the arson that seems to have sabotaged that very element of growth. How severe is the damage?
It's severe. I mean, I think it's certainly psychologically severe. The looters managed to target many of the indicators of progress. The CVS store was an indicator of progress. The refurbished Mondawmin Mall, which, by the way, a very attractive mall, and a lot of inner city communities around the country do not have a mall that is that nice, that is filled with so many stores. They attacked the indicators of progress. It's a real irony. I mean, it's economic cannibalism.
And can you explain it as a Baltimore resident?
You know, I'm an economist. One of the fundamental underpinnings of economics is rational behavior. We expect people to behave in accordance with their own economic interests. There is nothing that one can explain that happened Monday night using models of rational behavior. It's completely irrational. Looting Mondawmin Mall and taking out shirts or other forms of merchandise doesn't seem to pay much homage to the memories of Freddie Gray or to the efforts that many community leaders have made to bring more social justice to West and East Baltimore. These were crimes of opportunity. And these were people in the community preying on other people in their very own community. And their community has been permanently damaged. But the reputational impacts of this affect both Baltimores, both the upscale, urbanized, gentrified Baltimore, and also the more challenged Baltimore.
What kind of effects on both?
We've already seen a cancellation of a couple of major conventions. One of the growth industries in Baltimore is tourism. You know, our city does not have a great reputation to begin with. And with shows like Homicide, Life on the Streets, and The Wire, one can understand why. But our city in places is breathtakingly beautiful. It's gorgeous. And one of our favorite pastimes is to bring people into our city and surprise them with the graciousness and the glamour of Baltimore, particularly downtown. It's Oriole Park at Camden Yards. It's the Ritz-Carlton Residences. It's the new Four Seasons Hotel. It's the Under Armour campus. And that Baltimore has been hurt because now this perception is, you know, Baltimore's not safe. And for us to need the National Guard to maintain order, and of course the National Guard is most welcome in Baltimore. We thank them for their presence, I think all of us. But the fact that we need them there to maintain civil society, it's an embarrassment.
What kind of afterlife does this damage have? In other words, is there, you said that that already it's taking its toll economically and that conferences have been canceled. What do potential investors look for in a place like Baltimore now? I mean, can the city eke out some kind of opportunity from this?
Yeah, I hope so. There's a rebuilding process. Insurance monies will come in to varying degrees. But I'll tell you, it makes it hard for everybody. If students right now around the country are trying to make decisions about where they're going to attend college, how many students that would have otherwise attended Johns Hopkins University will decide not to attend Johns Hopkins? Maybe it'll be Georgetown. Maybe it'll be the Northwestern or the University of Chicago. But all of a sudden, their parents don't feel that Baltimore is safe enough. How hard will it be for Under Armour, T. Rowe Price, Legg Mason, and other companies to recruit people, talented people from other communities to come into Baltimore? It probably becomes that much harder. How much more difficult does it become for convention planners to be persuaded to bring their conventions to Baltimore and help us fill our hotel rooms, which pay hotel taxes to the city, which feeds into the provision of public services? All of these things add up.
So what is the best argument that Baltimore could put forward right now to erase the perception that Baltimore is a land of no opportunity and instead enhance the idea, as you say, or the fact, as you say, that Baltimore is indeed rich in opportunity and that developers, for instance, should up their investment in the city? I mean, what's the message that has to go out?
Well, you know, developers have been upping their investment in the city.
But you're worried about what's going to happen now.
Yes. Well, in the more affluent parts, they have been. And, you know, I still believe that there's going to be a lot of young people who are going to continue to move to Canton, Locust Point, Otterbein, and other fabulous urban neighborhoods.
Right. But they're already fabulous.
They're already fabulous.
They already have money, and those aren't the areas that need more investment.
That's one of the great ironies of economics, right, which is that investment tends to be greatest in those places where it's least needed.
So what can the city do now?
There has to be statements by city leaders that, look, you know, we are changing today. We are going to create a culture of high expectations for everybody, including our children. You know, one of the things that's been so frustrating is to hear leadership in Baltimore set low expectations for our kids. You know, on the one hand, they decry in many cases the violence. They say it's not acceptable. But look, these kids, you know, they'll say, but look, these kids are poor. And that's almost like a partial excuse. There should be no excuse for this. It's absolutely true that our kids don't have the level of opportunity that's enjoyed in Baltimore County or Howard County, where there is an abundance of families that have millions of dollars of net worth. But that should actually induce our young people to work harder, to prove to the world that, yes, they might be of minorities, they might be poor, but that as individuals, they have the ability to achieve. There's some great stories that come from Baltimore City Public Schools. You know, kids going to Harvard and other top schools, it can be done. There is a land of opportunity there, believe it or not, despite what you hear.
Do you think that the people of Baltimore feel that way right now, residents of Baltimore? I mean, you are one of them. Do they still believe in their city, or has violence tinged their own image of themselves?
Oh, no. We still believe in our city, but our view of ourselves has deteriorated. I mean, you might remember on Saturday there was some violence in the city. And, many of us were quick to suggest that this was done by outside agitators. We did not want to believe that we ourselves could cause damage to our community. On Monday night, we could no longer make that claim. That was us. That was us. And so our view of ourselves has been diminished. That's my view. I'm despondent. But we will be reborn. Tuesday was a much better day in the city. You saw people coming out trying to protect the police. You saw people trying to protect the physical infrastructure of the city. That's the real Baltimore. We're better than what we were Monday night. We're much better.
Anuban Basu is an economist in Baltimore and CEO of the consulting firm Sage Policy Group. He lives in Baltimore and has raised his family there as well. Very nice to talk to you.
Privilege was all mine.
And now we want to get some good news out of Nepal, because there is so little. 5 days after that massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake stopped the country in its tracks, then plunged it into mourning, there have been rescues. A four-month-old baby. And then crowds cheered as teenager Pemba Tamang was carried away on a stretcher after being pulled from the wreckage of a building in Kathmandu. Eddie Thurston is a Fairfax County, Virginia firefighter who was part of a team of firefighters from that county that joined another team from Los Angeles to be part of the USAID Disaster Assistance Response Team that rescued that teen. Eddie's on the line from Nepal. And start at the beginning, would you? How did you even know where to look for him?
The government of Nepal, the rescue team, had found the victim, and a team from Los Angeles arrived on site, a small team, and then they called us to come in and assist them with the government of Nepal to help extricate the victim.
Well, we heard that this young man was calling out and that people actually heard him from under the rubble. What did you do once you got to the site?
Once we arrived on the site, we spoke with the Los Angeles team who are already on site, and they were kind of advising us of the situation and equipment needed and that sort of thing. So we started trying to arrange all that equipment and getting some more assistance on site to assist the Nepal rescue team.
What kind of equipment do you use? Because we've seen people with their hands, with their bare hands lifting things, but what did you do?
Sometimes that works well. I mean, we just have many different types of tools to breach concrete, to lift things that maybe have somebody trapped. Airbags, different kind of jacks, that sort of thing, just to help lift concrete or any kind of thing that may be trapping the victim.
Yeah. Well, you're doing this work, and then there he is. I mean, look, I'm sure you have found lifeless bodies. What was that like to, yeah?
It's always great. I mean, in these situations, a terrible disaster like this, to get a live rescue, It's just a great feeling, and we train very hard at this. We work very hard to stay proficient in this kind of work, and it's always good to be able to help somebody survive from a situation like that.
5 days. I mean, can you explain as a firefighter with what you know? How does that? How could he have survived?
I was also at the Haiti earthquake in 2010, and humans are remarkable, and it just many can survive many days in that type of environment. And that's kind of why we do what we do, to help get them out of their situations, yeah, even after that amount of time.
Well, 5 days. And not only that, you had, we could see in the pictures, you had what looked like hundreds of Nepalese watching. What was it like in the crowd?
It was very busy. I think everybody was very excited to be able to find this person and be able to get them out of that terrible situation.
Yeah. So how would you characterize this day in Nepal?
I think it was certainly a very good day. Like I said, we had many small teams out doing searches, trying to find a victim. And anytime we find a live rescue, it's just a very good thing.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, and do you think, are you still looking?
Yes, ma'am. That's my understanding. I think we're going to be sending more teams out tomorrow to search different sites in the hopes of finding another survivor.
Hmm. We wish you well. Eddie Thurston, Fairfax County, Virginia firefighter, part of the USAID Disaster Assistance Response Team that rescued a teenage boy today, 5 days after the massive Nepal earthquake, the rare sound of good news. It's here and now. This time, 150 years ago, the train carrying the body of President Abraham Lincoln was making its way to Springfield, Illinois, through Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago. Our Peter O'Dowd has been visiting some of the cities along that route, reporting on Lincoln's legacy and how his efforts to save the Union during the Civil War resonate today. You can listen to all of his reporting at hereandnow.org. But today, a little detour to Decatur. Lincoln lived near Decatur, Illinois, long before he became president. It's said that he made his first public speech right there in the center of town, where a statue of a young Lincoln now stands. It was the summer of 1830. A 21-year-old Abe Lincoln had been working on a nearby farm when he climbed up on a stump barefoot and called for improving navigation of the nearby Sangamon River. Here's Clemson University historian Vernon Burton.
I remember the statue in Decatur. I think that sort of captures that essence of the barefoot boy, the idea of Lincoln the commoner, Lincoln who has risen from his roots but isn't ashamed of them.
Well, and that spot in downtown Decatur is where Peter picks up our series, Tracking Lincoln, with this postcard from the road.
Across the state line from Indiana into Illinois, and all of a sudden you're deep into Lincoln country. Then drive into downtown Decatur, and you've entered a shrine to the 16th president. There in the central square is that statue of Lincoln, barefoot upon the stump. Across the street is another landmark, a miniature replica of the Macon County Courthouse, where Lincoln once practiced law. Lincoln fever doesn't stop there. A few steps away, the Lincoln Theater marquee hangs proudly over Main Street. And next door, the Lincoln Square Lounge, a local watering hole that's been in Andrew Chiligiris's family for three generations.
When my grandfather opened initially, this was a hat block and a shoe shine. In the time when the gentlemen wore hats and dressed up for work every day, especially when they had jobs downtown where this is located, and they needed a place to get the hats cleaned and the shoes shined, and it was kind of a gathering place for those kind of activities during Prohibition.
Hat block and shoe shine in the time of Prohibition, eh? Sounds like code for something else.
We do find evidence of some rooms in the basement that seem to be highly ornate for being in the basement. They have different marble floors and things like that. But to my knowledge, those are just rumors. I don't know of any speakeasies.
Chiligiris says that what makes Decatur unique has a lot to do with its past. Here's a tidbit. Decatur is home to the original fly swatter, invented in 1900 by a local entrepreneur. When I visited Main Street, it was quiet, but Chiligiris says the city was once an important rail hub between Chicago and Point South that drew immigrants like his Greek grandfather to the city. And until recently, Decatur was the headquarters of the agri-giant Archer Daniels Midland.
So, you know, we're agriculture-based, and we used to have a lot of mines around the community, and that's a job that immigrants could do easily. They could come down and they could work in the coal mines, and they didn't necessarily have to speak English. And the other thing they could do is open restaurants, and a lot of immigrants opened different restaurants, like my grandfather, and different candy shops and coffee shops and things of that nature.
As things change in Decatur, the connection to Lincoln endures.
Clearly, he kind of became part of the family. This establishment is the reason that our family got its roots in the United States, and Lincoln's played a role in it, for sure.
And so it's fitting that above the bar at the Lincoln Square Lounge is yet another tribute to the 16th president, a portrait of Lincoln with words from his second inaugural address, "With malice towards none," transcribed across the top. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
But if Lincoln had Illinois, George Washington had Virginia. He lived out his later years at Mount Vernon in Alexandria, but did most of his growing up at Ferry Farm in Fredericksburg. The house itself, long since destroyed, but after years of excavation, archaeologists have found its exact location, along with hundreds of thousands of artifacts. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Matthew Schwartz of WAMU headed there to hear that tale.
Down an old dirt road and across a muddy field, archaeologists Dave Maraca and I are heading toward a hillside overlooking the Rappahannock River.
They arrive here when George is 6, and they stay here. George stays here until he's about 24, but his family stays here for like 30 years. And so we have a big chunk of the Washington story here at Ferry Farm.
Maraca has been director of archaeology here since 2001. It's under his leadership that a team of archaeologists uncovered the Washington home in 2008.
And what we argue is that the place that is Ferry Farm shapes or helps shape the man that George becomes.
After his father died, young George Washington lost his mentor, his guide into gentleman status.
And so he needs to learn about 1,000 things, and he has no one to introduce him to.
So Washington heads into the town of Fredericksburg just across the river and learns to fence. He learns to shoot pool. He goes to the theater. He even gets dancing lessons.
This town, this landscape, allows him to overcome a lot of the hardships that life had dealt him with. It helps him become sort of a very sophisticated guy.
The farm's location on the river also gave the young Washington a sense of the adventure the world had to offer.
Every day, George Washington sees people that are embarking on the adventure of their lives. They're going to cross that ferry and get on a boat and go someplace exotic like England or the Caribbean. Or, even better, they're going to come down here, wait for their ferry, cross, and go to the frontier, into the woods.
But before he could go off on adventures, Washington had years of growing up to do, and he did so right here on this hillside.
So this is the archaeological site. Those stones mark the corners of where the house was.
Am I standing on top of...
You're inside the Washington house.
Wow.
So step over here, you're outside. Which room are you in? You're probably in the passage. You can see this house from every house in Fredericksburg. It's a show house, and in order to make it a show house, they stuck it right on the edge of the hill.
Inside the visitor center, archaeologist Laura Galke shows me a picture of one of the items they found digging here.
Is that a wig?
Yes, it's a wig.
Hair curler?
Yes.
Galke gets pretty excited about her team's latest big discovery. The residue on that hair curler shows evidence of 18th century hair powder.
And what's newsworthy about the Washington's hair powder was that it was cheap hair powder. So we're even finding ways the family economized in the use of their powder. They were adulterating it with oyster shell.
It may sound like a small detail, but Galke says this is an important find. It shows how the Washingtons lived in a period about which very little is written.
We're making strides into understanding the nature of George's life, the nature of colonial Virginia's during the mid-1700s, and new techniques for analyzing this material that no one else has considered before.
The findings have just been published in the Journal of Archaeological Science. Something that's unlikely to make its way into a journal is the location of a certain mythical tree about which young George couldn't tell a lie.
Where was the cherry tree that he chopped down and taught everyone about truth?
We're looking feverishly for it.
It sounds like you're being sarcastic.
Yeah. It's hard to find one tree in a landscape this big.
That's true.
The cherry tree story's importance is not whether it happened or not, but that people were exposed to it and people knew it. Every 19th century soldier knows that story. This is a Civil War battlefield, and when soldiers get here, they start looking around for cherry trees, and they find the pits, and they send them home. And so it doesn't really matter if that story is true or not. The fact that people know that story and sort of understand this landscape in that lens is what's important.
And even if that cherry tree is never identified, there's plenty to explore here. They've already found hundreds of thousands of fragments, and now it's time to put those puzzle pieces together. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Schwartz.
Today, climbers on Mount Everest got the go-ahead to resume their trek up the mountain. It's a welcome sign after the earthquake and landslide that killed 19 people at Everest Base Camp. The death toll throughout Nepal has now risen to above 5,000, and it's thought that thousands more bodies will be found in remote areas of the country. Sean Casey is with the International Medical Corps in Kathmandu. It's an aid foundation that's trying to bring help despite great odds. He joins us by Skype. And Sean, tell us what you and your team are doing on the ground now.
So we spent the day today trying to get mobile medical units to a number of different locations around Kathmandu and in other affected districts. Access is a real challenge right now. The earthquake affected a number of districts with very remote villages under good circumstances, some normally a walk from the end of the road. And there's heavy destruction in a lot of these remote areas. So we're doing a lot of logistics work now to access these remote areas and try to get care and water, sanitation, hygiene support to some of these remote, heavily affected areas.
And if some of the streets there, some of the roads, such as there are roads, are blocked or impassable, how do you literally move from one place to another? And how do you carry the aid supplies, the medical equipment with you? Give us an example.
Right. So International Medical Corps is now looking at multiple approaches, including trekking to these villages. We're looking at helicopter access. We're even looking at how we could potentially use drones to assess needs. So we're looking at every option in front of us. There's risks and challenges related to all of them. The choppers are really not available right now. They're being used for medevacs. And there's a lot of demand for them, as one might imagine. Walking in is obviously physically challenging and risky. There's still landslides happening. There's still aftershocks. And the ground is not stable in some areas. And walking in for 2 days doesn't give you much cushion in terms of safety for the team. And they're also not able to carry much. So really complicated response here and a lot of needs. And it's going to be hard to meet those needs in a timely fashion.
And you had mentioned drones as well. I mean, you have the low tech or no tech of walking and then the high tech, very high tech of drones. What would the drones, if you're able to employ them, what would they accomplish? Just surveying the area and the needs, or could they actually transport some of the aid material with them and do a drop?
I mean, at this point, there's many villages where we don't have eyes on the ground. So they've literally not been accessed by anybody since the earthquake on Saturday. So it would be about getting eyes on the level of damage. We can see if people are collected in camps. We're really concerned collectively in the response now about the possibility of disease outbreaks. Because people are living in camps with no sanitation facilities, unprotected water supplies, and there's a real risk in that scenario of disease spreading. It's also raining, and cholera is endemic here. So having a sense of what the needs are in very general terms would allow us to prioritize where to try to go first and what we need to bring, whether it's medical supplies or water sanitation supplies, things like that.
Yeah. Can you give us one example? For instance, I know that you were in the ancient city of Bhaktapur. Perhaps you can give us an example of how you got to Kathmandu, where you are now in the capital, what you saw along the way.
Right. So I was in Bhaktapur when the earthquake struck. I was in the old city doing some sightseeing, and the buildings collapsed around us. And we spent the afternoon trying to get back to Kathmandu. So wading through some of the aftershocks in squares where buildings wouldn't fall on us in the aftershocks, and then kind of sprinting through the narrow streets of Bhaktapur to get to the edge of town. And then we walked for several hours until we were able to find a car to get us back to Kathmandu to our hotel. And our hotel was damaged, and we ended up sleeping outside for the first couple of nights. There was some damage along the way. Some buildings had fallen. There were some cracks in the road, and everybody was outside. It was just massive numbers of people standing outside, afraid to go into buildings.
When you encounter a situation like that, how do you, as someone providing medical relief, prioritize what to do first?
We know that there are some clear needs in an earthquake scenario, immediate medical care, and then people are generally displaced into camps or forced to sleep outside because it's not safe to go into buildings or people are afraid to go into buildings. So we know that the priorities in an earthquake are generally pretty consistent. Medical needs, water sanitation needs, shelter, and non-food items like blankets and other basic supplies. because they are forced out of their homes. So it's generally pretty simple to know what's needed in general terms. And then we've been working on assessments since the day after the earthquake. The morning after the earthquake, I traveled to the area around the epicenter in Gorkha District and Dadin districts to assess needs, and we immediately deployed mobile medical units and started working on water and sanitation. And we're now working on psychosocial support as well, because there's a lot of trauma, there's a lot of anxiety and emotional distress among the millions of people who have been affected.
All right. Thank you very much for speaking with us from Kathmandu, Nepal. Sean Casey with the International Medical Corps. Nice to speak to you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.